Technology, Executive Director for Finance, and Executive Director for Operations. And in addition, we have other senior managers in both human capital development, strategic research initiatives, informatics and knowledge management, operations, information technology, and corporate and public affairs. But the core of our work is done by the people at the bottom left, the intramural directors, the directors. There are 13 intramural unit directors, and then the remainder of the 45 unit directors are extramural, working in the universities and medical schools. And these are the MRC research units. There are 45 MRC research units. There are 508 scientists working in those research units, of whom 308 are senior scientists, i.e. scientists with master's degrees at a senior level or with PhDs and medical degrees. And as you can see, we organize our work around the health priorities of South Africa. Obviously, the number one priority in South Africa is HIV and AIDS. And there are about, of the 45 research units, there are about 18 or so that do research in HIV and AIDS. But the three principal ones are the South African AIDS Vaccine Initiative, the HIV Prevention Research Unit, and the Gentle Ulcer Disease Research Unit. Tuberculosis is a second major priority in South Africa in health, and we've got four main research units: Clinical and Biomedical TB Research Unit, TB Epidemiology and Intervention Research Unit. They do mainly clinical trials and also operational research in TB. And then the Center for Molecular and Cellular Biology and Molecular Microbacteriology do more basic science research in terms of developing new targets for new drugs and vaccines, etc. And then the third major problem, health problem in South Africa, is pneumonia and influenza. And so our infectious disease research unit, number five, there's a diarrheal pathogens, immunology and infectious disease, inflammation immunity, malaria, respiratory meningeal pathogens. And then the fourth major problem is cardiovascular disease and diabetes. And we've got four research units there. The fifth major problem is crime, violence, and injury, and we've got a national program in that. And then the sixth is cancer, and there are three research units there. Health promotion is an important initiative in terms of improving the health of South Africans. Public health is obviously important in terms of the support that we provide to the National Department of Health and provincial health departments and other government departments and South Africans generally in terms of public health issues. So we have a biostatistics unit, burden of disease research unit, a Cochrane Center, health policy research unit, health systems research unit, etc. But then we also engage in cutting-edge research using the most advanced technologies in the world in genomics and proteomics to find new solutions for health problems. And those are the seven research units in that sphere. Women, maternal, and child health issues are obviously very important in developing countries. There are three research units there. Nutrition is a major issue, environment and health, brain and behavior, and, of course, African traditional medicine. And the two main research units in that sphere. The next slide shows the growth in MRC income. I must apologize because the slide that you have in your pack is incorrect. This is the correct slide here, and the numbers here are taken from the annual financial statement of the MRC from 2004 right through to 2007. And what it shows at the top of the slide is that a government grant to the MRC has grown in line with the medium-term expenditure framework, which was mainly entailed a 5% increase per annum in order to proof our research activities against inflation. The main growth of MRC income has occurred in the middle of the slide in contracts, grants, and services rendered. And as you can see at the far right, currently 237 million rand of research funding comes from those contracts, grants, and services rendered. These are mainly competitive contracts and grants. The MRC does not do research for the pharmaceutical industry in terms of product development. We do cutting-edge research to find new solutions and new technologies for health. We don't do service research for the industry or anything like that. And then there's other income. So total income currently is about 457 million rand, which about 55% comes from external sources. And as we mentioned, when we presented our budget and strategic plan, our feeling is that we'll be more comfortable if a higher proportion of our research income came directly from government. Our feeling is that that government grant needs to be twice what it is, and we presented some material to the CFO, the Department of Health, outlining exactly what areas we feel need greater investment, from human capital development to refurbishing our capital equipment for research, to building laboratories for clinical trial research, etc., etc. Nevertheless, we're grateful for the money that the honorable members of the portfolio committee and the honorable members of parliament vote for us every year, and we think we use it to good effect. That 157 million is the baseline budget from 2005-06, and it represents about 20% of government health research expenditure. So we receive about 20% of government health research expenditure, but we produce 40 to 50% of the health research output. So we think we're fairly efficient. The outputs include all the A-rated scientists in health research in South Africa are MRC unit directors. Two of our scientists received orders of honor from Mugubwe, from the president. In 2005, we produced 618 peer-reviewed publications. 87% of those publications are in international journals. So we're confident that 40 to 50% of the lab of health research output that we produce is probably the better half of the 40 to 50%, so to speak. In this past year, we produced 670 publications, so there's been an 8% increase year on year, and that's been a consistent trend over the past few years. We also produced new patents. We have a family of about 20 patents current and pending, and in this past year, we've actually produced 5 new patents in the past year. And they include patents on things like new HIV vaccines, etc. We produce about 38 technical reports a year, mainly for the National Department of Health, but also for other government departments and other institutions. Technical reports on health issues, be it something like XDR-TB or smoking in schools or whatever. We also build capacity. We graduate about 49 PhD students per year from our 45 research units, and about 50 master's students. And as I mentioned, we employ directly about 854 staff. That's an increase in the past year of 91 or 12%. So we are also creating jobs. So not only do we bring in external foreign exchange to conduct research in South Africa, we use that foreign exchange to create jobs and to train young South Africans to be scientists and technologists. There are about another 1,200 people in the universities and elsewhere who are either funded by us, receive bursaries and scholarships from us, or are involved in our activities. Now, obviously, transformation is a major issue for the MRC. We all know, honorable members, that before 1990, black people, particularly black African people, were excluded from scientific activity. And in our schools, young people were not taught science and math. So we have a major task in terms of training scientists, first of all, because we only have about 7 per 1,000 knowledge workers in this country, compared to a country like South Korea that has 70 per 1,000 knowledge workers. So South Korea has 10 times as many knowledge workers per 1,000 than we have. So we have a challenge in terms of building scientific capacity in this country, particularly if South Africa is going to meet its target of 6% growth by 2015. Scientific technology will be an important input factor, but also particularly of developing black scientists, particularly black African scientists, who were not taught science and math in school before 1990, and also colored Indian, and also women scientists as well, because they tended to be excluded. So anyway, you can see the progress that we've been making. Currently, in November 2006, at every level of the MRC, as you can see from the slide, from executive management down to unskilled workers, there was a degree of transformation underway. 80% of our executive management were black, 20% female. And you can see that there's been major changes at every level, both in terms of the proportion of black South Africans working for the MRC and women South Africans. Currently, the organization is 81% black, that's African black, Indian colored, and it's 67% female. And you can see lower down that 55% of the managers and researchers at the MRC are black. That's 178 out of the 320 managers and researchers. 33% of the managers and researchers at the MRC are black African. That's 104 out of the 320 managers and researchers. And 55% of the managers and researchers are female. That's 173 out of 320. So this is not just transformation going on at the lower levels of the organization. It's transformation going on throughout the organization. And we think that transformation work will continue. Now, getting on to whether we do all this research using the money that you generously vote for us every year, but what is it achieved? Well, obviously the research can only impact on the health and quality of life of South Africans if it is translated. And we use this acronym called GRIP, which means getting research results into policy, health policy, formulated by the Department of Health, but also by other government departments and provincial departments, into health practice, that's the health practices of doctors, nurses, pharmacists, physiotherapists, biokineticists, etc., into health promotion, that's largely the understanding of the general public about how they can protect their health, preserve their health, and then into products. So these are products such as new drugs, vaccines, medical devices, and also natural medicines, including African traditional medicines. So some of the highlights in research translation, more of them are listed in the annual report, but even the 150-page annual report cannot contain all the highlights of research translation that MRC scientists have been engaged in during 05-06, but just some of the highlights. And again, starting with the priorities. HIV and AIDS is the number one priority in this country. The MRC was instrumental in assisting the Department of Health in developing the antenatal clinic survey, particularly in issues such as biostatistics. And as you can see from the slide at the far left, the antenatal clinic survey has been going on since 1990. And you can see the growth of the epidemic of HIV in this country, reaching a peak in 2005. This is data from the antenatal clinic HIV and syphilis survey, showing the percentage of pregnant women attending public antenatal clinics in South Africa who were HIV positive. And as you can see, it reached a peak in 2005 at 30.2. Just last week, the minister released the data from the 2006 antenatal clinic survey, which showed a figure of 29.1. That doesn't look like a big change, but the numbers still have to be calculated, but if you extrapolate that to HIV within the general population, it could translate to something like 150,000 fewer people living with HIV. Now, what that implies, it's complex, but what it implies is that we may be succeeding in our prevention efforts in HIV. And the MRC does a lot of research in both HIV prevention, HIV treatment, and HIV care. Including research in the life skill program in schools, research on young people sexually active and how they can be persuaded to either limit their activities or use a condom, etc. So we think there may be some impact from the interventions of government, but also every single sector of African society has been undertaking the partnership against AIDS over the past 10 years. But it's difficult to know because incident rates are difficult to measure. Furthermore, the numbers will be, the complexity will be compounded by the fact that 350,000 people are on antiretrovirals and their lives are being extended. And that will tend to increase the prevalence of HIV because there are more people living with HIV because they're living for longer. In addition, the prevention efforts are impacting, but it's difficult to measure, etc., etc. But nevertheless, in terms of research, one of our research units conducts 4 out of 5 late-stage global vaginal microbicide clinical trials. I don't need to remind honorable members why it's so important for us to develop a successful vaginal microbicide. The use of the condom is 100% effective at preventing HIV transmission, but inevitably there will always be men who refuse to use a condom, either in their marriage relationship or in their casual sexual relationships. And so it's important to develop a technology that women can use to protect themselves from HIV if they cannot negotiate the use of a condom with their sexual partner. And we had a major setback with a trial earlier this year that you know of, the CONVAC trial, which failed. The analysis of the results showed that there was no significant increase in the number of HIV-positive women in the treatment arm compared to the control arm. So there was no evidence of any adverse effect from the microbicide. But nevertheless, there are another 4 trials still underway, which we hope that by the end of next year will have produced a successful microbicide that could reduce HIV transmission by approximately 50% and would be a woman-controlled prevention technology. In addition, the HIV Prevention Research Unit was awarded an NIH clinical trial facility to conduct clinical trials in microbicides, HIV vaccines, antiretrovirals, etc. And one of our contentions to the National Department of Health and government is that the NIH, Gates Foundation, Wellcome Trust, and whatever, pour millions of rands into developing these new technologies and treatment modalities, but their money cannot be used to build laboratories or clinical trial facilities or clinics. And therefore, the government agency in health research needs to build its own laboratories and clinics in order to conduct trials on new technologies for HIV prevention or treatment, for new TB drugs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's our contention, is that we, for the next 10, 20, 30 years, we're going to need to do an awful lot of research in these areas in order to develop new prevention treatment modalities for our people. And we need to do it in our own laboratories and our own clinics, so it's fine to use international money to actually buy the reagents and this and that and the other, but that money cannot be used for infrastructure. There's a trial underway on antiretrovirals for early seroconverters. This is because when a person becomes acutely infected with HIV, many of the memory cells are wiped out in the immune system. So though that person lives for the next 2 to 15 years without AIDS, nevertheless, their memory cells in their immune system have been virtually wiped out. So they're in a fragile state. And eventually, after 2 to 15 years following the initial infection, they then develop full-blown AIDS. So if we could develop a treatment for people when they become acutely infected, it might preserve the memory cells and slow down progression to full-blown AIDS. Our Cochrane Center does meta-analysis of all the evidence in disease, including AIDS, for instance, showing that cotrimoxazole reduces mortality in AIDS by 30%. And that's important because the emphasis is only on antiretrovirals, but as the honorable members know, in South Africa, we talk about comprehensive treatment because the full panoply of treatment for AIDS includes antiretrovirals, cotrimoxazole reduces mortality by 30%, multivitamin, and treatment for opportunistic infections. So the treatment of AIDS is complex, it's not straightforward, and it's comprehensive. And as you know, the comprehensive plan currently has about 282,000 people on treatment, and could be reducing mortality from 30% per annum in people with stage 3 or 4 AIDS to about 10 to 15%, major effect. And as I say, it complicates the analysis of trends in prevalence, etc. And the MRCU also is responsible for peer review and allocating funds in research in a comprehensive plan. Now, in tuberculosis, we do a lot of work as well. We do a molecular analysis through DNA sequencing for resistant TB. A lot of work on trying to understand where the MDR and XDR TB epidemics come from, how they can be prevented using the most sophisticated molecular techniques in the world. Also, doing research on understanding how the TB bacillus lives and operates in terms of its metabolism. Also, in the third bullet, research on the treatment of MDR-TB, showing that MDR-TB can be cured, though XDR theoretically is incurable. And then, also together with NHLS, conducting research on new diagnostics to reduce the time for diagnosing drug-resistant TB from about 2 months down to about 3 days. And there's a big demonstration project underway at the moment, together with NHLX, in looking at how two of these technologies operate in the field. And then the third major problem for health for South Africans is that of influenza and pneumonia, accounting for about 78,000 deaths a year in 2004. And the problem of avian flu, with the potential to cause a global pandemic, and it's important that the MRC and other scientists and technologists in South Africa develop our capacity to develop our own drugs and vaccines for avian flu, because when the pandemic does hit, if it does hit, the stockpiles of Tamiflu and whatever avian flu vaccines have been developed by then are going to be kept in the United States and Europe and whatever. And it's important for emerging economies like South Africa, Singapore, etc., to be able to develop their own drugs and vaccines for avian flu and any other influenza for that matter. Our respiratory meningeal pathogen research unit has done a lot of work on Streptococcus pneumoniae, which accounts for about 2 million childhood deaths a year. Of the 10 million children who die every year, a fifth of them die of streptococcal pneumonia, which is both treatable, 98% treatable, and both preventable, 80% preventable, using conjugate vaccines. And this unit is a world leader in vaccine research in strep pneumonia. And I've been appointed to an expert group called Global Vaccine Initiative, which will be meeting in July to develop a program for Britain, Germany, Norway, and the Gates Foundation for spending $1.5 billion on advanced market commitments to provide pneumococcal vaccines for the world, with the potential to save about 2 million childhood deaths a year, prevent. Malaria, we've done a lot of work in malaria, and it's been involved in both rapid diagnostic tests for malaria as well as combination treatment, artemisinin combination treatment. But most importantly, the work of the MRC together with the provincial malaria control departments in KZN, in Mpumalanga, and in Popo, and also Mozambique, have resulted in WHO changing its global policy on residual indoor spraying of DDT. Which is a major, major achievement. Because as honorable members know, malaria is the number one scourge on the African continent, certainly socioeconomic terms. And then this is a slide just illustrating the change from the left in terms of incidence of malaria per thousand population in 1998 and 1999, compared with on the right in 2004 and 2005. Astonishing changes, which result in both less death and suffering, but also, of course, have enabled the economic development along the Lubombo spatial development corridor between South Africa and Mozambique. And women's health, as you know, HIV, for example, is very much a feminized disease in South Africa and Southern Africa, and our gender and health issues, for instance, show that something like 90% of our young men report having forced a woman to have sex. 8% report having sexually violent towards an intimate partner. So this issue of gender-based violence is very important and probably impacts on HIV as well. And within our schools, the Youth Risk Behavior Survey showed that 14% of boys aged 11 to 20 reported having forced someone to have sex with them. So we do a lot of socio-behavioral research in trying to understand the determinants of such gender-based violence and how it can be prevented. And also doing biobehavioral work, showing how all these things impact on sexually transmitted infections, which, as the honorable members know, increase HIV transmission. Syphilis, gonorrhea, and other sexually transmitted infections are probably one of the major reasons why the HIV epidemic in Southern Africa has been so severe. And of course, one of the primary interventions there is primary healthcare to both detect sexually transmitted infections and treat them successfully in order to reduce HIV transmission. But we're expanding beyond the issue of gender and health in HIV and STI to the issue of men's health and behavior. And the fourth bullet, we started a research initiative in this area. We signed an MOU with Eastern Cape House Traditional Leaders to look at the practice of initiation amongst our young boys and men in Eastern Cape, and issues of circumcision, whatever, which, as honorable members know, are very topical at the moment, because circumcision has been shown to reduce HIV transmission by about 50 to 60%. But clearly this idea of simply mass circumcision through the public health sector is much more complex than that, both in terms of the sociocultural issues as well as the biomedical issues. But anyway, we're doing research on the cultural and biomedical issues. And then in terms of health promotion, we like to understand that in order to keep people healthy, it's important to understand what the risk factors for disease are. Unsafe sex, obviously, the number one because of the HIV epidemic. But violence is important, alcohol, tobacco, obesity, underweight, etc. So, for instance, the research that we've done on tobacco control, we hope has been able to influence our government, including the portfolio committee, on issues around tobacco control, particularly amongst school learners, among children, and also in terms of bans on smoking in public places, etc. But chronic disease is the fourth or fifth major problem in South Africa. There's an epidemic of cardiovascular disease, so we do research in this area, and we have worked with the Department of Health in terms of developing the Youth Fitness Charter, the Vuka South Africa movement, and the National Health Promotion Strategy. We did the National Youth Risk Behavior Survey in 2002, and we hope to repeat again in 2008. And we gave evidence to this committee on the Tobacco Product Control Amendment Bill in 2007. Particular issues such as the possibility of snus being used as a gateway drug for nicotine addiction in young people, and issues of increased violence for smoking in public places, etc. The environment health is an important issue for us in South Africa, and the MRC has done a lot of work on lead poisoning, both in terms of the introduction of lead-free petrol in January 2006, but also the issue of lead in paint, particularly paint on children's toys. And as a result of that research, we're able to work with the Department of Health in terms of developing a national lead awareness campaign, in the third bullet here, and also monitoring lead levels in paint through using sophisticated machines that can measure those lead levels. And then paraffin safety is an important area, and our Crime, Violence and Injury League program developed a policy brief for government on the issue of packaging of paraffin products to prevent poisoning the children and to prevent shack fires. Alcohol and drug abuse are major, major problems in South Africa in terms of the determinants of issues like violence, road traffic injury, HIV, you name it. This is a major and great problem, and we do a lot of research, particularly through our Alcohol and Drug Abuse Research Unit, on things like the tick epidemic in the Western Cape, crack cocaine, use of cash, but also how HIV prevention interventions impact in terms of alcohol and drug use impacting on condom use and sexual behavior, because we think they do have a major impact. Nutrition is a major issue in South Africa, both in terms of undernutrition and overnutrition. We face both those problems in this country. So our chronic disease lifestyle unit has shown in a randomized controlled trial how food can be manipulated in order to reduce blood pressure in the community. And what I mean by that is reducing salt content of bread and tinned foods, etc. But on the other hand, in terms of undernutrition, our nutrition intervention research unit has shown the importance of vitamin A in resistance against diarrhea and respiratory disease, and also using new foods like the orange fleshed sweet potato, which can provide high amounts of vitamin A for young people in particular, and also health promotion activities around food gardens, etc., etc. Maternal and child health, we do a lot of work through our Diarrheal Pathogen Research Unit on the rotavirus vaccine. It's in phase 2 trials at the moment. We do the work with WHO. And we also do work through our Maternal Infant Healthcare Strategy Research Unit on monitoring and evaluation of prenatal care in South Africa, working with the national and provincial departments of health in this respect, and establishing a prenatal problem identification program. African traditional medicines, lastly. Our South African traditional medicine research unit has done a lot of work on malaria, and we have isolated two molecules from South African plants that have potent anti-malarial activity. We've patented them, and we would hope that we will be able to take those products to market to produce pharmaceuticals against malaria. But we also do the twin track of looking at the use of the 3,000 South African plants that are used in medicinal use in South Africa, to study how they're used, to evaluate their safety and toxicity, and also to try using scientific methodology to try and confirm whether or not they are efficacious. And these include the use of traditional medicines, both in HIV and AIDS, in tuberculosis, in sore throats, like pelargonium is very good for sore throats, in diabetes. We are developing diagnostics and therapeutics for type 2 diabetes mellitus using South African plants, using molecules extracted from South African plants. And we're doing that in partnership with the University of Southern Denmark. It's a public-private partnership, 42 million rand initiative, which we hope within 5 years will produce diagnostics and therapeutics for diabetes. In all this, we are careful to ensure that the intellectual property of the traditional healers and the communities from which these traditional remedies come, some of which are hundreds, if not thousands of years old, that their intellectual property rights are protected, because there have been too many examples, including the Hoodia example with the same people, where IP rights were abused, and we are careful to ensure their IP rights are protected and that they can share in the potential commercial benefits of a drug that may come to market in 10 to 15 years from a molecule extracted from a South African plant. And with AIDS, we are doing a soon phase 2B trial of a four-plant combination which looks as if, from the case reports, looks as if it has powerful immune modulating properties in people living with AIDS. And we do research in extracting the active moieties from these plants and testing them against HIV-infected PBMCs, white blood cells. And I've shown that some of these agents do have molecules that do have activity against reverse transcriptase, which is reverse transcriptase is the enzyme that some of the antiretrovirals act against. So we've established a scientific basis for some of these modalities. We also do telemedicine research, showing how telemedicine can be used in primary health care with a testing site in Cabo, evaluating the Mindset Health Channel, which is used to educate patients sitting in clinics awaiting antiretroviral therapy for AIDS on issues about HIV, about prevention, about the use of antiretrovirals, etc., and various other initiatives in telemedicine. The South African Vaccine Initiative is housed with the MRC. The discussion in DST and other quarters about taking SARVI out of the MRC, my personal feeling is that that would be ridiculous. HIV vaccine development, as honorable members know, all over the world is only funded by governments, because the pharmaceutical industry will not fund HIV vaccine development. The risks are too high, the costs are too high, and so governments, be they the US government, the British government, the Swedish government, are only the ones who have to pay the cost for HIV vaccine development. But more importantly, the ethical issues around HIV vaccine development, particularly clinical trials, etc., are so profound that, in my view, it is not appropriate for any independent agency or whatever to be undertaking this work. In all the countries in the world that we interact with in collaboration with HIV vaccine development, be it the NIH, be it the British MRC, etc., the work is only done by government statutory councils and government-related organizations, because government pays a check, and also the issues around testing and developing these agents are particularly profound. Issues, for instance, of adolescent HIV vaccine trials are a very, very thorny issue. So though some may think that this can be separated and put under different departments or whatever, whatever, my view is it should remain under the MRC, under the Department of Health, and I believe that pretty strongly. But anyway, the program is a 45 million rand program funded by the South African government and ESCOM, involving 223 people in South Africa, plus people all over the world, making the vaccine in the top left, and our own vaccine candidates may go into phase 1 trials, hopefully, early next year. Doing the immunological assessments in the middle of the slide, testing the vaccines in 6 clinical trial sites around South Africa, doing research around the behavioral issues around HIV vaccine development and also the ethical issues. Complex program, the most successful HIV vaccine development program in the developing world. And I say that without hesitation because all my international colleagues say that. And our success includes not just the design and construction of vaccines at UCT, but the fact that we've been able to do transformation within this cutting-edge program. In that, in the latest round of proposals, of the 22 principal investigators, you can see in the middle of the slide, 14 are women, 60% are women. Before 1998, only 10% were women. And of the 22 investigators, 10 are black, that's 40%. Before 1998, only 5% were black. Also, we now involve three historically disadvantaged institutions in this research. And we're also doing, we also have clinical trial sites in rural areas, which is also new, in 6 of the 9 provinces of South Africa. And we've also incorporated community and behavioral science components into this research, because as I say, these are very profound issues, which governments need to keep a close eye on, and which a statutory council like the MRC is best suited to steward. Currently, we've done about 4 phase 1 trials since Farley started in 1999. There are 2 phase 2 trials completely underway, and these include the first test of concept phase 2 trial in the world since the VaxGen trial 4 years ago. And we hope there'll be phase 3 trials beginning within a few years. And we're also working with BioVac. This is a public-private partnership between Department of Health and the private sector, as you know, in order to manufacture vaccines for research within South Africa using a technology transfer agreement with Italy through a €23 million HIV vaccine clinical trial program funded by the Italian government. And then we also do technology transfer in terms of spinning out companies in DNA-based cardiac diagnostic tests, neurosurgical devices, vitamin A supplemented biscuits like Caratino, the diagnostic and therapeutic project in type 2 diabetes mellitus that I've mentioned with the with the University of Southern Denmark, telemedicine projects, hopefully with the Chinese government and the University of Stellenbosch, genetic ancestry, which hope we might establish, hopefully, with NHLS, possibly, and then traditional medicine. We have a plant at Delft that processes, purifies, and sterilizes traditional medicine for use in research initially, but of course, potentially, there could be a commercial aspect in the future. So, honourable members, to finish, the MRC, we hope you'll agree from this annual report, continues to grow from strength to strength in terms of depth and breadth of its research portfolio, addressing the health priorities of South Africa. There is an 8% increase year on year in research publication outputs, and 87% of those publications are in international peer-reviewed journals, and they represent 40 to 50% of the research output of South Africa, with only 20% of the money. There's been a growth in the external income of the organization over the past year. It's been a 30% growth. There are increasing numbers of black and female scientists at doctoral and postdoctoral level within our research units. We are translating the results of our research into health policy, health practice, health products, and health promotion. And we feel that the MRC can move into the future confident that it can deliver on its mandate of using research, development, and technology transfer to provide new health solutions for improving the health and quality of life of all South Africans. Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members.
Thank you very much. Honourable Morgan, you want to kick in? Thank you very much. Can we hand over to you?
Thanks.
I won't even make any comment.
Thanks, Dr. Mbewu, for another fantastic presentation. A remarkable organization, I think, that does fantastic work, as you say, for the health of all South Africans and beyond, because so much of the work is used elsewhere. However, I'd like for you to talk to the specific matters which are raised by the Auditor General under emphasis of matter, because they haven't been addressed in your presentation. Not to be a party pooper, this, as I said, this is a fantastic organisation, that's clear. And those were your fraud prevention plan, which was raised, whether that has in fact been approved by the board subsequent to this. Then the Auditor General raises inconsistencies between the reported outcomes and source documentation, and of course the measurement of performance as well. Those were the three emphasis of matters that were raised. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sandell.
Yes, thank you very much, Honourable Morgan. You're quite correct. These were emphases of matter in the raising annual report of 05-06. In terms of the fraud prevention plan, yes, we have developed a fraud prevention plan over the past 2 years. It was passed by the board last year and has been implemented. The CFO has been leading implementation of that. And it has included the establishment of a whistleblowers facility. The numbers on our website, it was established, it was launched in November 2006. And there have been about three cases reported through that whistleblowers program, and those cases have been followed up. In terms of outcomes and source documents, yes, there were disparities in terms of our key performance indicator report and our strategic plan. We've worked diligently to ensure that our strategic plan is specific in terms of the key result areas and the indicators in those key result areas, and the targets that we set for ourselves each year within those key results indicators. And also in terms of our key performance indicator report, reporting on whether or not those targets have been met. So you know, we have applied our minds to that and have been very careful in the KPI report that we've been preparing over the past several months to ensure that every single detail in that KPI report can be verified with source documents so that we can report accurately on our use of public resources. And in terms of performance management, of course, that includes the issue of performance management, ensuring that we can show how our various research units and support directorates are performing through verifiable indicators and targets and source documents that verify that those targets have been met or exceeded.
Do you think we have this problem of fraud prevention comments by the AG in the 2004-2005 annual report? And it's recurring again.
Yes, Honourable Chairperson, you're quite correct. I think the 04-05 report mentioned it. The MRC was tardy in addressing the issue, and the 05-06 report mentioned it. But the MRC has now dealt with the matter, and as I say, over the last 2 years, that fraud prevention policy has been developed and implemented, including the whistleblowers facility.
Which year?
We've been developing this over the last 2 years, and it was passed by the board last year, 2006, and implemented last year, both the fraud prevention plan, including the whistleblowers policy facility.
Will I be right if I take you to your report? I think this one, annual report 2005 and 2006. Just want for my ease of understanding. I've recognized the hand. I just want to take the point of Honorable Morgan. If you turn to page 124. Financial instruments. The MRC is exposed to the following risk as a result of financial instruments. Fair value, interest rate risk, credit risk, liquidity risk, cash flow, interest rate risk. And I'm sure both things are embedded in the fraud prevention plan.
Yes, Honourable Chairperson. In respect of this, some of those issues are addressed in the fraud prevention plan. But in addition, together with the board of the MRC, over the last 2 years, we've been working diligently in terms of improving our risk management policies and establishing, the board has established a risk management committee which works together with the executive in terms of ensuring that we identify the risks. So together with KPMG, we have an exercise in terms of identifying what were the major risks for the MRC, including some of these risks around credit and liquidity, and ensuring the MRC has programs and processes in place to diminish and control those risks and address those issues. So that's ongoing work in terms of risk management, and the board has a special committee specifically designed to work with the executive in terms of addressing those issues.
Very much. Honorable Martinella.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chairperson, 2 weeks later, the MRC was here with us, and maybe first one needs to thank Dr. Mbeu and his team for a much well-balanced report, as always. But 2 weeks back, they were here with us. And in one of their statements, I should think they were presenting their budget, they said that they are losing a number of researchers and scientists. But today, when you look into their annual report, I just want maybe Dr. Mbeu to bring a balance in the whole issue. In relation to what has been said of losing researchers and scientists, I just want to know as to whether this does not really impact on the work of the MRC of the researchers now. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other question? Can we take everyone in the meanwhile? What members are processing the cross-reference in the document? Professor Bill?
Honorable Atsunela. You're quite correct that there is a problem in human capital development in this country in terms of, first of all, attracting scientists into career in science, and in terms of retaining them within that career. The problem relates partly to salaries, but that's not a severe problem in the past because we addressed that issue. They relate mainly to the issue of career paths, in that for young scientists doing a BSc honors, then doing a master's and then considering a PhD, they are deterred by the fact that post-PhD there is no career path in science, either the MRC or the universities. Now, we have been addressing that through our capacity development initiatives by trying to establish programs right through from BSc honors to master's to PhD to postdoc and beyond that ensure that there are opportunities for scientists to move through that career development pathway from the age of 25 right to the age of 65. But our feeling is that there needs to be much greater investment in this area, in human capital development. And our thesis is that government should be investing much more in developing career paths for scientists, both within the Science Council and also within the universities, because we all know that science and technology is a critical part of ensuring a prosperous and successful modern economy. So we do have a problem in terms of losing researchers. It's not a severe problem, but we feel that we could address the health research issues much more effectively and develop more scientists and technologists if there was greater investment in career paths.
In the said, I think, comments of the Auditor General, your page 114, where he says that your strategic plan does not include the desired level of performance in terms of your strategic objective. You presented last week, was it last week? Or say 2 weeks ago on your strategic plan, but AG, in his comments, on 114 says that your strategic plans are not in line with your level of performance in terms of your strategic objectives. Could you comment on that?
Yes, I think the AG here was commenting on the strategic plan of 2005. Since then, we've developed a strategic plan in 2006 and also a five-year strategic plan for 05 to 010. And we have been careful to pay cognizance of the AG's criticisms by ensuring that in that strategic plan, the nine strategic objectives of the MRC have clear indicators, have clear targets, that these targets are time-bound, and that within our KPI report that goes into the annual report, we are able to report on our performance in meeting those targets or exceeding those targets. And so we hope that in the KPI report that we've almost finished, that will be going into the annual report for 06-07, that the AG will be satisfied with the progress that we've made in meeting those criticisms.
Okay. What's your medical aid?
It was exclusively ResMed, as was the case for most of the science councils, but last year we opened it up for the employees by giving the option of using any other medical aid that they may wish to use. So the majority are still with ResMed, but many have opted for other medical aid, such as Discovery, etc.
So if they say that on page 131 that your medical aid fund is not registered with the Pension Fund Act, how would have thought the medical aid is registered with the Medical Aid Act, which was supposed to be reviewed fairly soon? In fact, are you not violating the law there?
No, no, but Chairperson, I think they were not referring to the main medical aid there. ResMed is registered. There was a subsidiary medical aid that was, if I remember rightly, specifically for retirees. I'm not quite sure how it works. I should have brought my CFO to answer that question. But it referred to a medical aid that was established in order to deal with the idea of the issue of post-retirement medical aid, specifically for about 20 or so employees. And they pointed out to us that this was not registered, and therefore we had to deal with that by closing that and providing other solutions for those particular employees or ex-employees.
Because if we register, if we register Professor Baker, that's an clarity. It then says that far from authority. He then says the fund is therefore not funded in terms of the definition per accounting. I think this is your audit committee 116. Am I right?
Yes.
However, certain assets have been specifically allocated to the purpose of covering the related defined benefit liability. That's 10.2 on 131. CFO is not here.
Yeah, I should have brought the CFO, and I apologize for that, Honourable Chairperson. But we are aware of this problem, and we have dealt with it. We can perhaps provide you with a written clarification as to exactly how that's been dealt with. But it was an issue that was raised by the AG last year, and we have dealt with it.
Why is the CFO not here?
Unfortunately, he's actually overseas at the moment. He's on a course overseas. Our notification of attending was arrived late, and he was already overseas.
Honorable Madena?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I would like to echo my colleagues in expressing appreciation and congratulations for Professor Bale. For excellent work done in the MRC. I think all of us at one with him when you argue that there has to be an increase in funding for the important work by government. And then clearly one could detect from the report by virtue of many of the scientists, including himself, being involved in international work is another indication of the good work that they are doing, that their good work are recognized internationally, and one wishes to congratulate him and his team around those important achievements. If you said a couple of things with regard to TB, say with specific reference to XDR, which he indicated is theoretically incurable. Now, we are facing a major, we are on the brink of a major crisis on the issue of MDR and XDR, TB, say person. And one would like to have an understanding exactly where the MRC in finding alternative forms of how that in actual fact stop this disease from in a way destroying the population. Chairperson, if one wants to look at it crudely. And one is, to an extent also, one can know that the tablets, TB is an old disease, it's coming on now for more than 50 years in terms of the current TB treatment. Some of the medication that have been used have been taken off the market, but there's indications that those medications are being considered now to be employed in the strategies in fighting MDR, TB, say. One is interested to know their comments, in particular what the MRC is doing in developing medicine that will indeed treat both MDR, but importantly also XDR, TB, Chairperson. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chair, I just want to get clarity from MRC as to whether, for instance, when you start on page 113 to page 117, the understanding is that MRC is a statutory board that is effect. But when you look at the report of the Auditor General, I don't understand as to whether the executive is audited at its own level, the board is audited at its own level, or the audit committee is also audited at its own level. Does this not cause maybe some sort of a confusion at the end of the day? Because that is where you pick up number of things, whereby the Auditor General would say this is not in line in terms of this act and other things. I just want to get the clarity around that.
Thank you very much. Professor Mbeu?
First of all, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Mandela referred to the issue of TB and particularly MDR and XDR. As the Honourable Members know, the problem with MDR and XDR is not new. XDR-TB was first described in several countries around the world, including the United States and Russia, some years ago. But the reason that the epidemic in KZN achieved such renown, so to speak, was because South Africa has a problem in that 5.5 million of us are living with HIV, and we are particularly, those of us who are HIV positive are particularly susceptible to XDR-TB. So the concern, both in the South African government, among South African scientists, and the WHO, is that the XDR has the potential to be particularly catastrophic in South Africa, because 12% of us are HIV positive. Now, what are we doing about it? First of all, the MRC was involved together with others in identifying the epidemic. There was not routine screening for drug-resistant tuberculosis in South Africa, and so the MRC has been working together with the Department of Health and also with WHO and also with health departments from other countries in terms of improving the screening for drug resistant TB, and also working with NHLS, obviously, in that regard, and developing new technologies for detecting drug resistant TB, such as the demonstration project that I described to go find diagnostics from Geneva, which would shorten the time for diagnosing rifampicin resistant TB from about 2 months down to about 3 days. Also, in terms of doing operational research, to try and find out, we have good TB control programs in this country. We have dot coverage of over 80% or whatever. Why is it that in a country that has these programs, that have plentiful supply of TB drugs, why is it that we have this problem, first of all, with TB cure rates that are not the 85 or 95% they should be? And secondly, our growing problem with MDR and XDR TB. Also, we're doing basic science research to try and understand how drug resistance supervenes amongst TB bacilli. We're also developing surveillance, for instance, a project that the Clinical and Biomedical TB Research Unit is engaged in with the Provincial Department of Health in KZN in terms of embedding some of the surveillance techniques they've developed within the TB control program in KZN, so that we can accurately and quickly identify both MDR and XDR TB. And then also in terms of alternative therapies, first of all, developing new drugs for TB. I sit on the board of the Global Alliance for TB Drug Development, and many of the portfolio drugs that we have in our global program are being tested in South African research units. In fact, our clinical biomedical TB research unit is the only unit in the world that is testing all five of the new TB drugs currently in development. There's no other unit in the world that's testing all five. But the trouble is, TB drugs take 10 to 15 years to develop. So the next new TB drug will probably only come to market in about 2010, 2011. The last new TB drug that came to market was rifampicin 30 years ago. So the world was not investing, and we were caught unawares by this global problem. So, and then in terms of the tablets, yes, Honorable Mandela is correct. There are tablets for drug-resistant tuberculosis, but unfortunately, they do have high levels of toxicity. The Department of Health and Medicines Control Council was quick to ensure the supplies of these tablets, such as capremycin, etc., were available in South Africa, but it's not simple because there are issues of toxicity. And we do have the centers in both in the Cape and around South Africa where people with both MDR and with XDR TB are being treated, but it's complex because of toxicity and other issues. XDR is technically incurable, but that's not always the case. We're also looking at issues of using immune modulators, immune boosters, together with TB chemotherapy, in order to improve the patient's response to treatment, immune modulators such as MVACI, Mycobacterium VACI. Honorable Master Miller mentioned the issue about the MRC as a statute council, and how does this impact in terms of the oversight of both the board, the executive, and the committees. What we do at the MRC, like other statute councils, is to ensure that we have both internal and external auditors. We ensure that the audit committee, which meets four times a year, receives reports from those internal auditors. There's a rolling audit that goes on through the MRC every year, so that, for instance, of the 12 support directorates, at least three of them receive a detailed audit every year, and that audit report is presented to the audit committee and also to the external auditors. So there is close and detailed oversight over the MRC, its board executive, and its committees, and we endeavor to comply with the PFMA and other acts. And just for information for the honorable members, you're aware that the South African Medical Research Council Act, or bill rather, will be brought to the portfolio committee, because there are certain technical issues within the Act that need to be brought into congruence with the PFMA. And as the Minister announced in a budget speech that will probably happen this year.
Thank you very much. Any other questions?
Would I be right, Professor Beu, if your legal services is outsourced, am I right, within the department, and then your internal audit outsourced, who then tracks this internal auditing all the time in the department?
The internal and external auditors are not in the MRC. The internal auditors are from outside the MRC, but on a continual basis, they conduct audits of the MRC. Our own legal service department is an internal department. We have three lawyers who work in that legal service department. But the internal auditors are from outside. We don't have internal auditors embedded in the MRC as such. They come from outside, and they work within the MRC through the year and doing a rolling audit.
They work through the year?
Throughout the year.
Incorporated are actually inside the MRC through the year doing internal audit. So you've got special people who then rely in terms of their inside the budget of the MRC.
So they are within the MRC throughout the year, having access to all the books, etc., etc., and as I say, doing a rolling audit of usually about three departments per year, and reporting on that to the audit committee and ensuring that the AG is informed.
What's your attrition rate?
It's not that great. I think it's the turnover rate of the MRC. I think it's the order of about 2%. So it's not actually very high. There are the two sides to that coin. On the one hand, if we're an organization with the employees are happy, we would hope we have a low attrition rate. But on the other hand, because we do engage in activities of human capital development, we would hope that our scientists, as they become trained and more expert, do actually move on to other organizations and to other careers. So it's a complex issue to address. But we put it in our KPI report, but it's, as I say, it's there are two sides to it, a positive and a negative.
Another question, ma'am?
My hand has never been up.
Oh,
but
it's not up.
But let me ask you a question anyway. Thank you very much. Yeah, in this reporting document, there is a slide which deals with the clinical trials and etc. And I had Mr. Mbeu, Professor Mbeu, mentioning an issue of contract report. And the minister at the same time referred to that report while answering questions in Parliament last week. She referred to something like a blind contract report. Maybe at this stage MRC can some sort of brief us around that blind report. If unblinded again, maybe we can have a clue on what is happening around that report. Thank you, sir.
Honorable Madeira.
Thank you, Chair. Just two questions, Chair. One would want to believe the term practice would be that internal auditors are what is referred to as internal auditors. Now, we've heard that Boro is a company that has been contracted to provide its service. Now, that will obviously mean, Chair, that the cost implications is somewhat very high. Chair, and one would hope that the MRC would, through Kubota, create and develop internal capacity to do the internal audits themselves. And of course, the external audit, that remains what it is, Chair. So I just want to know, they are not thinking along that lines, chairperson, to have a reoccurring, ongoing expenditure like this, whereas capacity could be developed internally to do the very same service. Then, Chair, the second one relates to recruitment, Chair, specifically with regard to employment equity targets, Chair. One sees that 0.03% of the staff or research are disabled, Chair. The question is, are there any programs in place to attract more disabled staff, say, by virtue of perhaps headhunting students that have been offered bursaries that are disabled with the future prospect of being employed at the MRC, say, for some things?
Thank you very much. Was we must break for the National Health Laboratory Services. That's the last question. Honorable.
The last one. Okay, thank you very much. Chairperson, I just want maybe the MRC in their own thinking in relation to alcohol and drug abuse, né? As to whether they see this warning labels as something that would assist us in relation to drug usage and alcohol usage. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Honourable Chairperson. In relation to the Conrad trial, Honourable Members may remember that this trial was terminated prematurely in January because of the suspicion that there might be more HIV positive women in the treatment group than in the placebo control group. Subsequent analysis of the data since the trial has been terminated has shown that there was no significant difference in the numbers of women who became HIV positive in the control group or placebo group compared to those in the treatment group. So there was no evidence that the cellulose sulfate was increasing HIV infection. And there was also no evidence of any adverse effect of the cellulose sulfate. The other issue that was a concern at about the same time were reports of possible protocol and ethical violations within the study, and honorable members may remember that there were reports in the newspaper concerning this. The minister convened a meeting together with herself, her DG, her DDGs, the Medicines Control Council, the NHLS, all the senior officials within health and its statutory bodies to look at this matter. And I recommended at that time to the minister that it would be appropriate for the National Health Research Ethics Committee to conduct an independent inspection, on-site inspection, and report on the ethical and protocol aspects of the Conrad trial. This was done under Professor Dutoy, the chairperson of the National Health Research Ethics Committee. And his report is being delivered to the minister. And, you know, she will peruse that report and take whatever action that she deems appropriate. But informally, we have heard from the National Health Reserve Ethics Committee that they did not find any evidence of any protocol violations. In fact, they complimented the clinical trialists on the quality of the conduct of the clinical trial and no evidence of any ethical violation. So those are two reports. One is the report from the actual Conrad trial itself on whether there was any evidence of increased HIV infection or any adverse events, and the answer is there was no evidence of that. And the second one was a report from the National Health Research Ethics Committee, and that is in the process of being sent to the minister, who will deal with it as she sees fit. In terms of Honorable Madela, talking about internal auditors, this is a matter that we've considered over some years as to whether we should establish an internal audit function within the MRC itself. And in fact, one of the things that has made us hesitate has been specifically the issue of cost. You will see from the actual annual report what our audit costs are in terms of audit fees, and we have been careful to keep those under control. And what we have established has been that it will be more expensive for us to establish the internal audit function within the MRC than to have internal auditors coming from outside the MRC to do that audit function within the MRC. But that is obviously something that needs to be constantly reviewed because, of course, that situation may change, and we keep a careful eye on that. In terms of recruitment and employment equity targets, the MRC has made progress in terms of employment equity in relation to Black South Africans and women, but Honourable Madeli is correct that we have not done very well in terms of employment equity in terms of employing disabled South Africans, with only 0.3%. We do actively headhunt and try and identify both disabled scientists and support staff who can come work for the MRC, but have had not much success. But it is an area where we are aware of our deficiencies and are attempting to correct that. And then Honourable Massimello has asked about alcohol and drug abuse. Yes, it's a growing problem in South Africa. We don't have much research on whether warning labels work on alcohol containers or not. We have research that demonstrates they work in terms of cigarette packs, that they do have an effect on behavior. But we don't know whether they work in terms of alcohol containers. We suspect that they probably do, but perhaps that's an area of research that we should be undertaking.
Well, I think, Honor Professor Mbeo, I think we should sincerely thank you very much. I think as Honor of the Garra Smoken was saying, I think one thing we always appreciate is that the adequacy of preparation from your institution is always very good, and we really highly appreciate that. And I'm sure you have taken note of the questions on the financial side of it. It's unfortunate that the chief financial officer was not present today, but it's always better when questions are asked, they are all answered here. Because when they are written, when they want to follow up, and then it's a recurring decimal. We normally want to find a decimal that we can solve. Anyone recurring, we want to dismiss it. So we really want to, just as a lesson, we always learn in this way. But thank you very much, Professor Mbeu, for your team. We shall allow the National Health Laboratory Services to prepare their own systems and then take on board. Am I right? This is the only report you've given us.
Oh, thank you. Any report down?
Oh, you did.
Have you got the spare one?
Can I get the spare one? Can I get the spare one? You can give me the spare one. Oh, you are a star. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's only for the guest.
Thank you. I'll try to phone this number. It says he's unavailable. Oh, Isaac, what is his number? Let me run and check it. Okay, so that's
thank you very much. We have National Health Laboratory Services 2005-2006 annual report. The CEO is leading the team, as usual. He was here with us in this team last time. I think about 2 weeks ago, am I right? 4 weeks, okay, top line.
Thank you very much. Can we hand over to you?
Thank you, Honorable Chairman, Honorable Members. Last time we got caught without our team, so we made sure this time we didn't get caught without our team. And when we were down here for our early report, that's probably about 2 years ago, one of the things we discussed was that we could have KZN in the NHLS. Today, on my right, or on your far left, we've got Lenny McKeezy, who's the regional manager for KZN, and they came into the NHLS in October last year. Then next to Nelly, we've got Stan Harvey. He's in an acting role for one of our regions. Then Stelios Michas, he's the IT manager of the NHLS on Stan's right. Mary Ross, who heads up our National Institute of Occupational Health. Voya Kozi, who is our company secretary. She joined us in April last year. And then Mark P.A., Priscilla May on her right. And then two of our members have disappeared down there, so I think we'll have to send a search party for them. I don't know where they've gone. But Joyce McCarley, she's the regional manager for the northern region, which is Limpopo, Mpumalanga, part of Northwest, and part of Gauteng. And then Sipho Mashlati, he also disappeared. I must wonder where the two of them went to. But he's the regional manager for the Western and Eastern Cape. Then Funzeni and... Funzeni is our HR manager on my left there. And then Suleiman Minty on my left over here is our finance manager. And then on my right is Martin Hale, and he's in research and academic affairs and quality assurance. So we've got quite a good team, quite a big team, and I'm hoping they can give me any assistance if the questions become a little difficult. Presenting a report like this, the difficulty is that circumstances have overtaken the report. So you're going to find that my presentation sort of alternates a little bit between the report itself and some of the subsequent events that have taken place. The report itself, or the presentation from the one in front of you, I've swapped a few slides over, so there's a little bit of an overview before I touch the financial information, so just bear with me, you might find that alternating a little bit. So the NHLS essentially, and the bulk of the NHLS, is to provide a cost-effective laboratory service, and we'll touch on that. Secondly, to provide training for health science education, and in particular registrars. And then support health research, and then the last one is surveillance, and that's largely done through National Institute of Communicable Diseases and National Institute of Occupational Health. That's the footprint now, and if you remember last time when we presented, KZN was just a pink spot, and now it's been populated with 53 laboratories that have been brought into the NHLS. I've shown this slide a couple of times, but that's where we're based in Sandringham, where we've got a lot of our reference centres, and that's our offices in Sandringham. The organogram now, as you can see, has been populated with KZN, with Nelly coming into the NHLS. Seems a bit far from them, probably a bit small. And what we've got here is we've got our operations down here, which is covering the nine provinces. Then we've got our staff functions, finance, HR, information, and quality assurance. And then we've got our surveillance over here with a little entity for the National Cancer Registry. The structure of the NHLS starts right down to primary healthcare level, and we service approximately 6,000 clinics on a weekly basis. Then we've generally got laboratories in the district hospitals. Then obviously we've got our bigger reference type laboratories in the regional hospitals, and then we've got the tertiary hospitals, which are linked to the medical schools. And we include, in Gauteng, we include Barra with the tertiary hospitals, and in the Western Cape, we include Red Cross Hospital. The National Institute of Communicable Diseases, which is based in Sandringham, and National Institute for Occupational Health, which is based in Bronx, in Johannesburg. The service model, and it's a very strong component of the NHLS, and you'll see it come through our financials, is a fee-for-service model. We do have preferred provider status with the public sector. We are responsible for training, and in particular registrars through the medical school, and we have a research mandate. Facilities, 265 laboratories, of which the 53 came in from KZN this year. Personnel, 5,500 personnel. 1,900 of those are technologists and technicians, 180 scientists, and 150 pathologists. And the last number is the number we're trying to encourage, and that's to increase our registrars, 200 registrars. So what I'll do is just a slight overview of the background to it. Just go straight into the financials and have a look at those. They're sort of towards the back of the annual report. And this schedule here is in the annual report, but it's a summary schedule of the performance of the NHLS from inception. The first period was an 18-month period where you can see we had a deficit of 104 million rand. Then the next 12-month period, we sort of more or less break even with a small loss of 14, 15 million rand. Then the 12 months of 2005, that was 101 million rand profit. And you can see for the first 3 years, which was in the previous annual report, we more or less broke even. And then in the current 12 months, it's under review today, we generated a surplus of 176 million rand. On a turnover of 1.3 billion rand, and the accumulative of that for the NHLS is 150 million rand accumulated surplus of a turnover of 4.2 billion rand. There are some transfer payments. The initial capital of the NHLS was the 30 million that came from a trust, and then there were transfer payments of 40 million rand around the startup of the antiretroviral program. It was spread over 2 years, and the rest of the funds are generated internally. If we look at cash flow, again, that schedule's in the annual report, you can see the first line is at the operating level. Then you've got the non-cash items being added back to that. You've got your working capital coming off that. And you can say your non-operation cash generated is the centre block there, which are the transfer payments, the grants received from government, and some interest that we've got. And then the last line for after cash generated, we've got the investment in capital, and you can see it is very limited in the early stages of the organisation. So, in the first sort of 18 months of organisation, we only invested 17 million rand in property, plant and equipment. The second sort of, or the 12 months following that, 22 million, 56 million, and again last year we invested 56 million in property, plant and equipment. And the net increase in cash was 288 million. Now, what we found with the organisation in the early stages, the capital wasn't necessarily available for us to make the investment that we needed to make. And so we slowed down capital investment. In the period following this, and you'll see it in the next annual report, we've invested about 130 million rand in capital. So we've now got the ability to increase, and more than double from the 56 million into the next period will be about 130 million that's gone into capital. The working capital, or the net cash, is at a point in time. So it seems fairly large, the 288 million at the end of March. But what we do find is that as we progress into the year, April, May, with the setting up the budgets in the provinces and things like that, a lot of that cash is absorbed into working capital again because there is a delay in payment from the provinces to the NHLS. So the recommendation from the audit committee is really that we should have about 3 months working capital in available resources at the year end, and then we find that sort of by May we've used up a lot of that working capital, and again in the December period when things quieten down, we find a slowdown in payments, and then there's a pickup into March where we generate quite a lot of cash. But working capital is an important element in terms of getting our payments coming through. The next one is the audit qualification, and in the annual report we did get a qualification, and we've addressed that, and the qualification related to the previous year's closing inventory balance and not the year under review. So we ended up with a qualification in the previous year because of the closing inventory, and then that was rolled through for the following year as an opening inventory balance, but it didn't have any effect. There were no qualifications generated during the year under review, which was 2006. Then we had two emphasis of matter in the annual report from the Now, the first one is completeness of external grant research income. And the reason, and it's tending to be a technical one, which will probably be repeated each year until we can find an alternative way of managing the research. And what tends to happen in this particular one is that the researchers put in numerous proposals to various funders, and the status of those proposals at the financial year end is not necessarily known at that point in time. And they can't determine what is outstanding at that point in time because of these proposals. And it's pretty common to most research organizations that you have a technical emphasis and matter on research grant program, but it doesn't reflect a lack of control or governance over those research programs. The second one is the title deeds. When the NHLS came into existence in 2001, our Act provided for certain properties to be transferred from the state or from the SIMR into the NHLS. And this is a program that we've been working on virtually from the inception of the NHLS to get these properties transferred. And the emphasis on that will be repeated again this year. And it is possible, I wouldn't like to guarantee it, but it is possible that it will disappear in 2008. My company secretary is looking at me and she's not nodding, so I'm not sure that she's agreeing totally on that. But the problem with that is that it's quite complex. It's not only from the provinces, but it's got to go through public works. And there's various levels of authorization necessary before these properties can be transferred. And it consists of properties in Johannesburg in Braamfontein, properties in Sandringham in Johannesburg, and a property in Port Elizabeth. So it's three properties, but it's a combination of the provinces and public works. And hopefully by March next year, we will have transfer of some of these properties, all of these properties. But it is something with public works. The next one here is contraventions of statute, and those were in place. The first one is the register of board members' interest in contracts incomplete. And this one may be something that should not have appeared, but it did come from independent board members to a certain extent not being willing to declare their full set of assets. We found certain problems in trying to get to the point where we agreed on the format of the interest in contract and declaration and things like that. So what we did is we had a monthly register that was signed where people indicated that they didn't have any interest in the discussions, but they were a bit reluctant to declare their full assets and the organizations that they worked for. That one of those. Fraud prevention plan not fully implemented. It's a partial implementation, and subsequent to this, we do have the hotline, and that should be in place with this next annual report. And then we did not have a materiality framework in our strategic plan, and this has been completed and it's been agreed, the materiality framework. In the materiality framework, the degree of reporting if employees were to be fraudulent is specified, but if it came to the executive and there was anything strange to the executive, the materiality framework is zero. So anything around the executive would be reported through that. Nothing would be in the materiality framework for the executive. The slide in front of you, and it's actually quite an interesting slide, and it gives an idea of the NHLS and the environment in which it operates, and that's around tariff development. So what we've shown here now is the tariffs of the NHLS over the last 2 years, and then forecasting what the tariff would be going into the future. So for the period under review, our tariff was 41 Rand on average per test. If we then took it through when we, at the end of 2006, or in March 2006, we had to calculate the tariff going forward for 6-7, and we budgeted a tariff of 4% for the period 6-7. And when we finished the year at 6-7, it actually turned out to be 3.6% our tariff increase, which took our average price to 42 Rand 50. And then at the end of the year, just sort of past now, we had to then project our tariff increase for the year ahead. And we opted to absorb a certain amount of inflation, and we've projected a tariff of 2.2%, and this time next year we'll be able to see whether that realized or whether we realize a lesser or greater amount. But really it depends on the product mix that we sell as to what that tariff increase would be. But I think the important one is the bottom half of that slide. To do a comparison between the Council for Medical Schemes National Reference Price List and the NHLS price list that we use. And you can see if we took the same product mix for the 6-7 period and calculated the average price, it would come out at 60 Rand rather than the 42 Rand, and it's 41 or 42% higher than the NHLS price list that we use for the state. And then again, as you can see, we've tried to contain our increase to 2.2%. For our projection for this year into next year, their average price would have moved up to 63 Rand, which would have been a 45% higher tariff than what the NHLS uses. And I think it's one of the measurements, and we use that as one of our key performance indicators to keep our prices a lot below the national reference prices, which is used by the private pathologists. The next one is just on our procurement, which falls as part of our finance. This slide is not in the presentation. When I look back at the questions from our previous discussions, this was one of the issues that was raised last time, and we hadn't actually got it into the presentation. But on our sort of spend that is sort of discretionary, and when I use the word discretionary, we don't have to use international companies for this particular spend. Out of 117 million Rand spend, 84% of that went through employment equity companies that we could, you know, place that money with. But it definitely excludes our international spend with the big providers of diagnostic equipment. And the structure of the NHLS is that we do not buy our analyzers. We have rental agreements, and the analyzers are provided through these rental agreements and the products that we buy from these companies. In this one, we presented a slide a month ago, but I think it's an important slide again just to highlight the expenditure, because some of the slides that come up later on are impacted by this particular slide. But overall, the NHLS is having about 3.6% of the provincial spend spent on laboratory services, and it varies from Gauteng at 5.6% to Limpopo at 1.9% of that spend, and then it includes the direct plus the conditional grants that are given through to the provinces. The NHLS billing comes from the next line. The population of the provinces comes through the number of laboratories, the population per laboratory, and then the health expenditure per capita in the various provinces. I'm sure you guys see these numbers fairly regularly. And then the lab expenditure per capita. So you can see from Gauteng, it's 74 Rand 5.6% of their spend to Limpopo, 21 rand per capita per annum spend, which is about 1.9%. So that's a structure that supports the NHS on a fee-for-service system. The tests are charged, so the utilization of our services is reflected in those particular numbers. Human resources. The NHLS, when it came into existence, had approximately 2,500 people. Over the years, it's grown until March last year. And then in October this year, approximately 1,000 people came across from KZN, which would have taken us to 5,200, and then grew out again at about 250 people in the subsequent period. In addition to the people that transferred from KZN. The workforce profile, the numbers on the left are percentage of our total workforce profile. And this slide, if we took the first two, the green and red, would reflect the change in profile from 2005 to 2006. And then the period to 2007, I've included it, and I don't know if that's the right thing or not the right thing to do, but it does include the profile of KZN. So it's not directly comparable, because it includes the profile mix from KZN. But definitely the 2005-06 shows the profile change across the NHLS. The next slide includes the senior executive of the organization. And you can see the profile mix changing. Some of the small changes are an increase in number. Some of the big changes is a change in profile. And you can see that coming through. The next slide is senior management. And this particular one, because the senior management are fairly small in number, is directly reflected and changed by the incorporation of KZN. And you can see from this particular slide that the mix from KZN on African male has dropped, and it looks fairly significant, but it is as a result of the incorporation of KZN, and there's a significant change in these particular numbers over here. And this particular number here again is that this is a dramatic increase in white male, but that again has come through from KZN and not through the traditional model of 5-6. The workforce profile of medical scientists, we're beginning to see a change developing over here. Again, it's a small change in total, and there's a lot of work necessary, but I think it will get critical mass as we go forward. The laboratory managers, here you can see the more effective change. We've got 265 laboratories, and you can see the change beginning to come through now. It does incorporate KZN, so there could be a distortion from KZN. Medical doctors and specialists, this is the area that there is a very slow and difficult change to achieve in the short term, but I'll show you a couple of slides later on. We'll be making quite large inroads at the registrar level, and that's where we employ our doctors mainly, and then they graduate through to consultants. So the doctors and specialists, you can see the change is not what we would like to see it. Again, slightly distorted by KZN. Medical technologists, the profile here again, significantly distorted by KZN. And you can see it in these two over here, which was not a predominant group within the NHLS, which is now becoming a more dominant group within the NHLS. Here's the registrar profile over that period from 2005 to 2007, and again, distorted by KZN, we've brought through a lot of registrars in this particular period over here that wouldn't have traditionally been in the NHLS and changed that particular profile. But the next two demonstrate what's actually been achieved in the period. So what I've done here now is I've taken out any distortion from KZN. I've just shown the 2005 and 2006 registrar intake and left out. And as at March 2006, KZN wasn't incorporated into it. So what we've got here now is that we've moved from 30 registrars in the 2005 period to taking in 60 registrars in the 2006 period. And it's reflecting our budgets and our increase in training. So we doubled the registrar intake from 2005 to 2006. The slide that's not added on yet, 2007, but we took in 55 registrars in 2007. So we've dramatically increased our intake of registrars. But the next slide then breaks down the effect of that intake. And what we found that, but in terms of African female, these are not percentages now, these are actual physical numbers of registrars that we've taken in. We've increased that from 5 the previous year to 12, African male from 4 to 7, coloured female gone up to 2, coloured male to 1, Indian female, and this excludes KZN, Indian male, and then white female and white male has jumped dramatically. But what happened, and the reason for increasing the number of registrars, when the NHLS came into existence in 2001, we had 135 pathologists. And by 2005, we dropped all the way down to 112 pathologists. And that was problematic, and it was for numerous reasons. One was that in the period 97, 98, 99, there was a cutback in registrar posts for tertiary facilities. And the NHLS was classified, or not the NHLS, but laboratory services were classified as tertiary, and the posts were cut back. When the NHLS came into existence, we were able to increase the number of posts, and we continued to do that. So that by 2006, we had only got back to 120 pathologists. So we started at 135, dropped all the way down to 112, and now up to 120. So the goal was to try and get 200 pathologists into the NHLS. So the work that we're doing is to try and increase the number of those. But we've filled every post we can possibly fill, and we hope to continue that for a few years. But as your pathologists drop, your consultancy registrar ratio is 2 to 1. So you can't train at a higher rate than a ratio of 2 to 1. Skills development, student medical technologists, technicians, that doesn't include the salaries on those. Student medical technologists, again, they train largely through the universities of technology, and then specifically registrars, we've increased, you can see, and the cost of bringing those registrars in. So each year you have the graduates coming out and then the new intake. It's a 4 to 5 year program, and a lot of our money has been pushed into skills development. Training, we're affiliated to the 9 medical universities, 50 universities of technology. We have 50 heads of departments in the medical universities as part of the undergraduate, postgraduate training. We graduate 35 pathologists traditionally annually, hoping to increase that by increasing the registrars to 60. Graduate 150 technologists annually. And I've included this slide now, but through NIOH, graduates 20 occupational health practitioners annually. Research, we have 6 joint MRC units, 1 MRF Center of Excellence with a focus on TB, cancer registry, 183 scientists, 400 research publications annually. Surveillance, we classify NIOH as part of surveillance. They celebrated 50 years. What is your previous title? Okay, it used to be the National Centre of Occupational Health, and then when it was incorporated into NHLS, it became National Institute of Occupational Health. So they celebrated 50 years last year of the existence, and they occupy the old medical school, the Vitz Medical School. We've got the move with the technological change that has come through that we all do sort of have the pleasure of using. National Institute for Occupational Health Activity, they are recognized by World Health as a collaborating center on occupational health. Referral center, and closely working, do work with the Department of Labor, and they work with the unions and the Department of Mineral Affairs. Have a comprehensive library, and they have a statutory autopsy service. We'll touch on that again. And the surveillance of occupational diseases, and then they are a reference point and heavily involved in training of healthcare workers. National provider for professional development, continued professional development, and applied research on exposure in the workplace. The international recognition hosted World Health Collaborating Centers, elected to membership of Collaborating Advisory Committee, International Hygiene to head that up this year, and a memorandum of understanding with HCL, Health and Safety Laboratory, working with the Swedish government. Center of Excellence for Measuring Silica, occupation initiatives, and that's really around the NHLS lab, setting up a pilot there that will be rolled out further to industry, but using NHLS as their pilot and their website. And here again, the autopsy service that we've got, and it's shows, and I think over that period of time, the number of mine workers has increased overall in the country. But it shows TB and silica and the link in occupational health, particularly in the mining industry. You can see the number of autopsies that we've done, and in the lower graph there is reflecting the rate per thousand of silicosis prevalence in SA mine workers in autopsy. NICD, we talked about this at length last time, but during the year under review, the Polio Research Foundation, which was established in the 1950s, had some fairly significant grants. And when polio was largely eliminated, they opted to fund viral research rather than polio. And with the performance of the investment that they've got, they had significant funding available, and they chose to look for one significant project for NHLS, and we put a proposal to them to put together a training center, and they funded the training center. Cost 12 million rand. It's been built on our site in Sandringham, and you can see the inside, the auditorium of it. It's got laboratory training areas, got an IT center in it, and it's becoming quite popular and in demand by the provinces for workshops and various sort of entities, but we kept it, you know, sort of in the health arena. But it's a nice facility that we've now got, a proper training center with laboratories and an IT center. One of the projects that we're involved with here is the South African Field Epidemiology and Laboratory Training Program. It's a joint project with CDC. And it's set up, and we're looking to train 12 field epidemiologists on an annual basis. This year we took in 11, we didn't quite achieve our 12. The NHLS is sponsoring 4 of those, and each of the provinces, or certain of the provinces, is sponsoring the other. And what we're trying to do through the field epidemiology is integrate field epidemiology and laboratory services into one entity so that we can get a seamless approach to surveillance in that particular one. It's a nice project. It's got all the components, you know, national government, NHLS, NICD, CDC, and it's the first project where the NHLS and particularly with it, or NICD, with Italian site, is to try and create a virtual facility. So rather than have the NICD site linked to VITS only, this program has been run through the University of Pretoria. I think it's the first of many more where NICD becomes a virtual facility and not locked into one university. These are just some of the brochures from that particular one. There's the SELTP bulletin. Also include short courses. The program I spoke about with the 12 students, it's a master's program, it's a two-year program, and people will graduate with a master's. They run a lot of short courses. And the next one is just as part of that surveillance, just to give an idea of how that operates. These were the polio isolates received in 2006 by other listed countries, and you can see what has happened in Nigeria and the polio, you know, outbreaks in that particular area. And then again, we monitor that, and you can see how it's spread across, and you know, it's reared its head in some of the endemic countries developing on polio. So it hasn't totally been eliminated. Communication, these are general communications that go out on a weekly or monthly or quarterly basis. Website, you know, CD, and a lot of this is published on our website. Diagnostic services. A month ago I touched on some of these, and I've changed the presentation on the CCTP program, or CC Management CMT program. Yeah, and I've left the TV one very similar to what it was. So on the CCMT program, I'm showing the list of existing and proposed laboratories. So what we've got in the red would be the existing laboratories where we have capacity for the program. Then we're showing in the green that will be brought into existence in 7-8. And then in the dark green at the bottom, that will be brought into existence over the next 2 years. So that's in the longer Eastern Cape, Free State, Limpopo, KZN. They seem to have pretty comprehensive exposure out there. And then you can see in the Northern Cape, some work, very low density, but to increase the accessibility to the program, and then that's starting some work to be done there to get access to the program. But what I've done here is I've shown a slide over the period of the NHLS showing the capacity in 2003 when we kicked off, and the capacity for the laboratories we have now in 2007 that have CD4 viral load and HIV PCR tests available. And you can see that from probably about 8, 9 CD4 in 2003 to about 47 in 2007 viral load. We try to make sure that we have facilities in each one of the provinces. That's going up from about 7 to 15. And then the PCR tests for neonates up to 8. But what we've done in this one here, we've measured the testing capacity, and this is the monthly testing capacity that we have in the NHLS for CD4 viral load and PCR. And you can see when we started out, probably about 25,000 tests per month, we're up to about 225,000 tests per month. And then we've got the viral loads and PCR. The demand versus the capacity, and the red number is the current demand for CD4 viral load and PCR testing. So what we try to do is say roughly at about 65% of our capacity as a demand, and increase capacity as we exceed 65%. And you can see at the moment, we're staying ahead of the demand for those various tests. Now, this is showing the growth of the program If there's time at the end of the presentation, people would like to revisit the slides. I've got those slides with me in terms of the outcomes of the CD4s and viral loads. But again, you can see the growth in demand. December is a normal dip during the holiday season. But there's a continuous growth that from 100,000 at the beginning or at the end of the period under review here to 165,000 over this. That's a 65% increase in the demand for CD4. Viral load, a similar pattern, 21,000 a year ago to 43,000, so that's doubled per month over the current year from the period under review going forward. And then the PCR from 6,000 to 12,000, again, it doubled on a monthly basis over that period. TB, and I think a number of the members are present that perhaps didn't see these slides last time. So I've included the same slides, just abbreviated slightly on that slide. But what we've got is the number of microscopies done per province showing the period to the end of 2006, not to March 2006. And you can see now that the total microscopies across the country have gone to somewhere in the order of 2.8 million microscopies on an annual basis. That's come through. But the important part of this slide and the slide that follows it, whereas the other one or the following one shows the population adjusted microscopies coming through, and if we look at Gauteng being on the left on this one with the highest number of microscopies and Northern Cape being on the right with the lowest number, on the next slide you can see the population adjusted numbers in Northern Cape has the greatest penetration of TB microscopy in the country. And it's quite encouraging, it's often not anticipated in Western Cape and Free State, and then going through with an average for the country of about 7,000 to 100,000 microscopies. So I think when Tony showed his slides a little bit earlier on in the work on TB, that you can just see the magnitude of what is actually taking place in the country. Then again, because of XDR, MDR, and the need to look at sensitivity, you can see the increase in culture, and the necessity is because of MDR and XDR. Again, you can see from the Western Cape being the highest number of cultures in absolute terms, and then in the next slide, the Western Cape is second highest, the Northern Cape are doing a lot of work in terms of looking at sensitivity to the drugs that we use in. So, NHLS, and what are we doing about MDR, TB, and XDR, TB? Again, MDR is a subset of all TB, and XDR is then a subset of that again. So, we've got that subset coming through. MDR, as was mentioned, is resistant to the first two frontline drugs, which is INH and rifampicin. And then if we take the number of MDR cases identified, this again takes us to the end of last year, you can see across the provinces what has been identified, and you can see the spike coming through in the Eastern Cape there. And that is the direct result of a ramp up in the culture facilities in the Eastern Cape. And then here we've got the XDR cases, and you can see again that ramp up in culture facilities in the Eastern Cape has isolated 45 cases. There has been a few cases further than this. I've got data that's come through, but XDR TB does take 3 months to culture. Not to 3 months, about 6 weeks, but you start by getting a culture first and then to do the sensitivity. So it's about 3 months, which is on the culture, and then the sensitivity on that culture coming through. So the data for the early part of this year has been validated, and it will be available shortly. But this was the data that was available for the full period of last year. Then, on the, and it was referred to the fine study that we're doing and the initiative that we're involved with,
This particular one is a fine strip. We can get sensitivity to iron age and rifampicin within a period of 48 hours. And then we can sort of, you know, use the appropriate treatment and then look for culture beyond that and avoid culture on microscopy at the first level. The problem that we still experience, and that's with the culture assay itself, is not culture, the microscopy assay itself, it only detects about 50% of the TB through microscopy. We've opted now to go for fluorescence and a new process which will improve that to about 60%. So about 40% of the diagnosis of TB still has to be through culture in the first place, but this is applicable to probably the 60% where we can get MDR sensitivity within about 48 hours. The second one is using the second one is FAR-FLOC, which is another diagnosis that can achieve a similar diagnosis of MDR TB, again within about 72 hours. IT strategy. With our IT, we're looking to provide more of the data that I've just shown now. So we put a lot of effort into the building up of data warehouses. Through the fee-for-service system, every test populates a database, and we have the results of those tests together with the sort of epidemiology of those particular tests. And our focus has been on that data warehouse. And as I've indicated with the TB and the HIV side, we can have the same with other diseases within the country. Second one is to start a rollout to tertiary and regional centres. And what this is web-enabled, where the hospitals and the financial managers can get access to the results of the, not the results, the financial information of the NHLS. Then the last one there is a web-enabled that the clinicians can get the results of our tests through to the various hospitals and provinces. And one of them is to try and assist the provinces with this information to build the TB registers with the provinces, because we have access to the information. Well, I've just almost repeated myself on the web-enabled, which is the previous one. What we've got now, and we're rolling it out, is SMS to the various clinics to shorten the turnaround time on the results side of TB microscopies, and that's working quite well. It's reliable now, but there are problems in trying to identify cell phones to get the SMSs out to. And it's not an easy one, because you need to be able to get to a single point in the clinic and not to various individuals that are on duty or not on duty. So we're looking for methods of improving on this, where we would build a cell phone technology into almost a printer, and hopefully that will come to fruition shortly, then that we can send the SMS directly to the clinic and it would print out in the clinic via the cell phone technology. But we also can do this via faxes. But it seems almost as though there's a better coverage of cell phone technology than landline technology. So we feel that we have a benefit of the SMS technology rather than the fax technology into the field. And then to build laboratory information interfaces to the provincial system. So that's the focus over there. Then KZN, which has been incorporated from October. We've gone out on tender for a laboratory information system which would improve the NHLS's laboratory information system, and we're hoping to have KZN on a full laboratory information system by October next year. So it'll take another just over a year to have the system up and running and have KZN fully on a laboratory information system. It's an initiative to really use KZN as the, not a guinea pig in the sense that they don't have an information system, but it's let them be the pilot for the next phase of information system in the NHLS. And the last slides that I'm showing here now are a project that we're working with Danel on.
And so I've just included this to give an idea of some of the innovation that we are getting involved with. What we find is that a lot of the clinics are inaccessible to road transport. And we're working with Danel now to see if we can use unmanned aerial vehicles to transport specimens. So we've got a pilot that is actually working at the moment, which will have a payload of about 500 gram or half a kilogram payload that we can actually put into a vehicle like this. This is an electric motor on this. The first prototypes were fueled, but this one's now an electric motor. We've got up to 52 kilometer routes running, prototype pilots running on this particular one. And what we felt is it's got a couple of benefits. One from the clinic being able to move specimens in a vehicle like this. But the other one is that we feel for students and for the rural areas where there doesn't seem to be that access to science and technology to the same extent, that the maintenance and the support of these would be decentralized to those clinics where possible, and the youth can get involved in driving a project like this. So that's really just the vehicle. It's on a catapult to get off the ground. And then the next one shows that as it takes off, it's just a dolly dropping out as the vehicle takes off. And it's using GPS technology. So it can measure its distance off the ground or its height off the ground, and it can go to various waypoints and do a circuit. It's in its early stages. To date, we've sunk in 150,000 Rand, and now sunk in 150,000 Rand. And we're looking to work with general funders to see if we can't put a lot more funding into something like this. It's very much in the early phases, but it's one of the fun projects to see if we can't overcome some of the problems of logistics and transport routes into the rural area. So that's my presentation. It picks up 2006 going forward, particularly the financials in the 2006 period, but looking at the service delivery going forward from there. But thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Robinson, for your very good and elaborate report. For now, the members, we open the floor. Thanks. Any questions? It's so clear.
We had the same report.
and again, Mr. Robertson has been very, very actually intelligent. He tried to in terms of this report, he brought all other issues which are very critical at the beginning of this report. Now, trying to ease that whenever you're going to question some other issues which were not there during the presentation of the budget, he has already answered to those things. For instance, the financial audit issues are number one today in the report. But really, I don't see any major differences to this report and the previous report.
Thank you very much. That's a compliment.
Yeah.
The one you
I just want for Robertson to elaborate on the scores of grade. Saying that that's how a process moved away from culture formation to new a process in terms of analyzing specimens in relation to MDR and FDR. Talking about the 72-hour diagnosis, which is extremely fast. How far are we with this? Chairperson, what kind of cost implications are there? There's something that certainly must be welcomed.
Yeah, the project currently is a joint effort between FIND, MRC and ourselves, and we're doing 40,000 tests along those lines with no cost currently. That's being funded by FIND. If I was to take a model, it's just a model of what's going on there. If we took through microscopy and we got a diagnosis of 50% of those positive results through microscopy, if we said again that out of 100 microscopies, 20 would be positive, okay, through microscopy, those particular ones would then drop through, and it's believed that about 1 out of 20 would be an MDR through the microscopy system, and those ones we can determine within 72 hours, that's the longest. If it comes up negative under microscopy, those ones then have to go into culture. That's the only way that we've got. So let's then take 6 weeks on that particular one. Then it means that we have to look for sensitivity on those particular cultures. And again, we feel that we will pick up maybe 2 MDRs that particular route through there. So out of 100 index of suspicion, we might end up with about 3 MDRs coming through on that side. But we still need to go quite a long way, because it's only the microscopies where this technology is working. But I think if we're going to eliminate, I don't know if we're going to eliminate TB, but if we're going to really make an inroad on TB, the quicker we can get a diagnosis of MDR, the less MDR will be circulating in the community, and we can cover that. And then ultimately, maybe, we've been talking to Roche, but it's in early days now, but they feel that they've got some fairly good PCR tests that will pick up TB in an earlier stage than currently that we're using culture for. And they've done some trials, but there are problems with picking up things that we don't like. You know, it's just too sensitive and not necessarily picking up only TB. But I think within another, say, 2 or 3 years, we'll have some other alternatives, and we'll be able to cut back on the number of cultures and then reduce the turnaround time significantly on that portion too.
Will I have read the report properly if I look into the audit qualifications and the audit comments, etc., that in the main, these issues don't come from the AG, but from within your internal auditing processes.
External auditors, yeah.
External, but not the AG. Why?
Not the AG, yeah.
Why no AG?
The NHLS, the external auditors report through to the AG, but the NHLS has had external auditors independent of the AG since its inception. Here's my financial.
Chair, the external auditors are appointed by the AG, so it's effectively a capacity issue where AG can't do our audit, so they appoint external auditors. So effectively, it's AG, but it's done by external auditors.
So nowhere in the report the AG owns up. For the entirety of the report, when I read it, it's only the opinion of the external auditor. There's no opinion of the AG. And this is a public entity, which therefore governed by the PFMA, of which the custodian is the AG.
Chair, I think the AG won't express an opinion because they didn't do the audit, so they'll hold the external auditors.
That's exactly the problem. That's exactly the problem.
Sure. If I was to put it into context, about 3 months ago, we appeared in front of SCOPA, and the trigger from that was the AG, and the AG was present when we appeared in front of SCOPA. And I think, in terms of our explanation, and we had the AG himself at SCOPA when we were down there,
I think they were satisfied with the explanation.
The explanation that the external auditor suffice for the role of the auditor general. I was looking at your human resources section there, especially the disciplinary processes. Will I be right to read that in the main, the people who are actually facing the serious issues of discipline and dismissal are mostly African? And why should that be the case? Is that my proper reading? Because that truncates through the report.
Chairperson, I think that's to a great extent correct. We've tried to investigate the reasons as to why, but I think if you look at the number of people that are being disciplined, they are in the lower ranks of the organization, and that's where we've decided to invest in terms of training to ensure that they understand more the issues, because if you look at the issues that affect those disciplinary cases are basically minor transgressions like your AWOL, where people are supposed to know policies, and we've investigated and established that most of those employees are not conversant with the policies of the organization, and they are being educated.
Yes, Jane, thank you. Your question has triggered something else in I'm happy about the investigation because can one's experience have taught you that in many cases disciplinary matters like that as you were saying, it's minor issues. It's where a member, this is what we have found, for example, in other entities, in particular at local government level, where a staff member, for whatever reason, are unable to come to work and call the supervisor. The supervisor then chooses not to acknowledge that, and then the staff member is subsequently charged, you see. And those that are charged are always the lowest. Workers, you see, the one that the least salary and in the main are African, semi-literate and illiterate. And I certainly hope that the investigation will indeed address that particular problem. But say, I'm tempted to think that the lab, I can't remember the name, in Fore University.
Yeah.
That one is part of the one in 40, what is it called? Here in the Western Cape?
The
MRC.
It's not
MRC. Okay. Yeah, because one has been informed about a lot of problems there.
I would have thought perhaps there are other reasons apart from awards that would have resulted in this situation, but I'm sure it's something we'll have to look into quite carefully. You see, this issue of the SMS will be quite an innovative development, that we are raising. You see, one of the, I'm sure you are aware, I was just looking at the map on Poly, and I'm sure you are aware that currently it's UNICEF, has been, Zimbabwe, South Africa, have been declared polio-free for some time. And there were, of course, fears in particular in Zimbabwe, that there may be given other socio-economic and political challenges there is the recurrence of the polio in Zimbabwe. UNICEF was busy with the process. Is there collaboration? I've seen that with the MRC and others. With others? Yeah, that's a map here. Is there collaboration between yourselves and the
other entities and subjects.
Absolutely. The NHLS was World Health, and World Health is based in the World Health is the office of all in the world, and collaborate with World Health and the whole of that very quickly. The information that you see on this particular slide is that these isolated
and sent to us, not to Europe. These actually isolated have been sent to us. So these isolated have been sent to South Africa, not to Europe. So if you look at the isolates in the country, it's very difficult to see them across the top. But you can see, you know, there's Angola on the left-hand side over there. You've got Eritrea and Ethiopia, you know, in that particular area there. So, you know, we've got, you know, the whole, there's Somalia over there. So you can see, now all these isolates have been sent down to us, to our laboratory.
Oh.
Yeah. So this slide is our own information from the isolate sent to South Africa.
Mm.
Oh, okay. No, there's a lot of collaboration.
Not up with
Ian. Thank you, Chair. As you know, I'm an alternate and it's not always attend this meeting. But I'm curious, I would like to know as to whether identified the TB cases and Limpopo as a stand here, the lowest, does it mean that the people of Limpopo are somehow more healthier as far as TB is concerned than other areas? And of course, on the page, and on page 31, this culture. I also realize that Limpopo and Mpumalanga are one of the lowest. Does it mean that you don't have centers between Limpopo and Mpumalanga?
If I can come in, because I'm managing the two areas. I think the first, let's look at the one that says total microscopy tests per 100,000 population. If you look at the population of Limpopo, even though I don't have the accurate figures to the last decimal point, versus Mpumalanga, Limpopo has got more people as compared to Mpumalanga then. So what it shows you is that they may not be testing as they should. I don't want to say accurately they are not. I think what the figures tell us is that they may not be using TB, the facilities the way they should. And we have laboratories throughout in all hospitals. We are represented and we're doing TB microscopy. And over and above that, for Limpopo, we have transport services to all the clinics. We've just reached the 76% mark on daily visits in the three districts, the Capricorn, the Skukuneng, and Waterbeck. And we're increasing in Mopani, Vembe, and Buthabela. The one that falls under. So it's not as if NHLS is not there. I would think, I'm tempted to think that the usage of the facilities are minimal.
Oh, thank you.
Maybe going to the culture, I want to say we don't have culture facilities in Mpumalanga and Limpopo. In Limpopo, we are at the very advanced stage. They've given us space. Space was the major problem. But in Limpopo, they've now identified, they've given us, we're busy renovating, which will be starting before the end of this year. Mpumalanga, we had huge problems with the facilities, where I personally went to see the head of the department. Myself, after identifying a space next to the laboratory in Nelspruit or Rob Ferreira Hospital, that didn't materialize, so we're moving to Ermelo. and we've been promised the space there. It's just a matter of space, because you can't combine MDR and other tests. You not only exposing yourself to risk, but also the issues of health and safety act that we have to comply with. Yeah, thank you. If I've left something, I'm sure the CEO can add up.
Thanks, Joy. The slide I've just put up at the moment is the MDR slide, and these are absolute numbers of MDRs that we've picked up across the country. And again, you can see in the Western Cape, where culture has been routinely used, we're picking up a lot of MDR cases. And then as we move down here, where culture's not been routinely used, you're picking up a lot less MDR cases. But I think the next slide, again, which is absolute numbers, reflects perhaps the management of TB. And as you can see, in 2004, we picked up one XDR case, but in 2005, we didn't pick up any XDR cases, or 2006 in lymphoma. And over the 3 years, we haven't picked up a single case of XDR in the Mpumalanga. Now, I think for us, and I think as a program management, these are issues that we need to address. Because if we're only doing microscopies, we're picking up positive TB, but the drug regimen might not be addressing all the problems on the ground of MDR and XDR. So I think there's an issue that we do need to extend and utilize. The fact that there's no culture facilities in the province is also as a result of not utilizing facilities. So if there's a culture request and it's a six-week period, those are transported through to Gauteng to have the cultures done. But now we're going to put down culture facilities in that area. But you can see from the previous slide about the number of cultures that we're doing, but it's an unlikely scenario that, and I think that's what we need to address, it's an unlikely scenario. But it's empirical data. It's not, we're not on the ground ourselves. It's just empirical data. But I could suggest that it's an unlikely scenario.
Thank you, Mr. Fuyana, for raising this question. It has helped us very, very much to see another picture. Honorable members, I would suggest we should stop here at 2 o'clock. It's the president's budget speech. I know you want to be ready for that. May we take this opportunity to thank you very much, Mr. Robertson and your team, for very elaborate and very, very efficient and very good, you know, preparations as usual. I think last time you came here for the budget and the strategic plan, I think you had excellent preparation similarly today. And as Honorable Masimela was saying, the way you put up front some of the audit emphasis issues is going to be quite helpful. As you say, and they will take your word, and we're going to see this in the intervening period, that these issues will be addressed and will not appear in the next audit report. We will be observing that very carefully, I think.